Can you tell us about the history of translating the American national anthem into other languages? Are there early instances of this happening?
Yeah, I think the big surprise about The Nation in Translation or the Star-Spangled Banner sung in other languages is just that there's actually a pretty long history and tradition, if you will, of people singing this, you know, Key's anthem, Key's English text, in other languages. And more recently, it's been pretty controversial, right? Because this sort of gets at the heart, I think, of what makes the national anthem so significant as a symbol, as a song, because it's not just a thing. It's sort of a process of being American, if you will. So it's as much a verb as it is a noun, I guess. And where the symbol is enacted, it really starts to make claims about identity, about who is singing, are they American, are they not American, do they have the right to sing this, is this sort of a sanctioned official performance, is this some kind of activism? I mean, all those things are sort of possible with how we use symbols in our lives. And right. So it's really, I think, here that patriotism, you know, sort of, you know, becomes an active social force rather than just sort of an absolute thing. It reminds me, in 2013, there was a young boy named Sebastian de la Cruz who sang the national anthem as a prelude to one of the playoff games. I think it was actually the NBA Finals with the San Antonio Spurs, you know, going up against the Miami Heat. And he actually sang it in English using exactly the melody that is traditional, but he was wearing a mariachi outfit because it's San Antonio, you know, it's right on the border with Mexico and southern Texas. And so there was an attempt to buy the, I guess, the management of the NBA and the San Antonio Spurs to really reach out to the community by having it performed by a local, you know, superstar singer who had actually sung really all across the country. But this young boy, I think he was 13 years old at the time. And, you know, the blogosphere, Twitterverse, whatever you want to call the sort of the social media activity sort of lit up with all this criticism because this young boy didn't look like an American, at least to some people, right? Because he was wearing sort of traditional mariachi garb rather than, you know, maybe sort of jeans and a t-shirt or, you know, a San Antonio Spurs t-shirt or something like that. So sure. So that's where we get at this notion where singing the anthem really makes a claim about who is American and who has a right to be American. And every time we perform it, it makes that kind of claim. So we sort of assume, I think, that everybody singing it just sort of fits this kind of bland, neutral version of, I guess, the definition of the word American. But actually, there's an incredibly diverse country. We have this sort of history of immigration, really. You know, almost everybody came from somewhere else, you know, at least who's been in power within the government, except, you know, Native Americans would be the only ones who were sort of here when the colonists arrived. And there are, in fact, versions in Native American languages, too. So this text by Francis Scott Key has been sort of stretched and changes over time and really, you know, has a lot to say about community. And there's a social theorist named Benedict Anderson who has this notion called the imagined community. And if you think about like the problem of being a nation in the 21st century, you know, you have these huge stretches of space, of geography, of sort of people, of viewpoints, of languages, of social class. I mean, all of these differences, and yet we're united in some way. In the United States with, you know, 250 million plus people, obviously all these people aren't your friends and neighbors, right? There's a lot of them you'll never meet. And so the things that sort of unite us are these patriotic symbols, are these sort of ideals and notions of patriotism that give us a sense of a shared purpose, of a sort of shared sacrifice, of wanting to help someone just because they're sort of a member of your community. It used to be that that was your neighbor, that was the person you talked to, that was the person you shook their hand. But these symbols sort of allow us to expand that notion. So anybody who sings the Star-Spangled Banner, in a sense, is our friend, is our neighbor, is part of our team. And so that's sort of the kind of thing that happens when you sing the anthem. So if you sing the anthem in Spanish, in 2006, you know, during the Bush administration, when there's a big immigration bill going through Congress, it's that context sort of resounds and echoes in a different way. It makes people, you know, sort of question, like, what is appropriate? Can you sing the anthem in Spanish? And at that time, there were all these you know, people got very upset at this recording that was released called Nuestro Himno, or sort of our anthem or our hymn, and it was sung in Spanish. And it's a fairly literal translation, at least on the surface, of Francis Scott Key's text. And you know, people rejected that as un-American. We should sort of pass a law that says you can only sing it in English, because it was a pretty aggressive move on the part of those who released it, you know, which was Adam Kidron and Urban Box Office, really to try to make a claim using all of these Latin pop stars that sort of were here, right? We are Americans too, and the name of the album was actually Somos Americanos, was We Are Americans in Spanish, right? And ironically, this text that they were singing is not a new translation. It's a translation that goes back to the World War I era from 1919. It was published by Schirmer with an arrangement by Walter Damrosch, who was the conductor of the New York Philharmonic.
And
you know, so it's this sort of almost official version that's then, you know, repeated and recontextualized in 2006 that becomes controversial. Right. And in 1919, when it was first published, it's really about sort of assimilation. It's about making Spanish-speaking people feel more comfortable in the United States, making them feel American. In 2006, it's about sort of raising awareness of the number of Latin immigrants that are in the United States and that they deserve their status as citizens to be welcome. But of course, it's wrapped up into issues of border security and naturalization and citizenship and all of these kind of controversial issues exacerbated by the financial crisis and the dot-com bubble and all those things happening. So as so many of these things, you know, controversial versions really tell us more about you know, the time and place in which it happens, about the sort of political viewpoints of those doing the listening and singing, as much as they tell us really about the song itself. The song just has this power to unite people, to symbolize community.
Right.
And then you have to go into these questions, well, where are the borders of that? Where does citizenship extend? Where does this symbol, where is appropriate or not?
Right. And do you think that there are benefits to having translations in different languages? Do you think there's diplomatic benefits or, as you said, bringing communities together? What comes out of making these translations available?
Well, certainly as a scholar, I mean, these are the moments where it gets really interesting, right? Where everybody's comfortable with the anthem and there's, you know, no complaints maybe is less interesting from an academic point of view than where there's controversy, because controversy shows the definitions of these, of the notions of American being sort of stretched and shifting over time. You know, interestingly, in 2006, when this first, you know, Nuestro Himno controversy rose, Condoleezza Rice, who was the Secretary of State at the time, you know, she's praised the notion that the anthem was flexible, that it was something that could adapt, that it, you know, was in all of these different versions, rap country versions. And she actually said on the CBS show Face Nation, she said, from my point of view, people expressing themselves as wanting to be Americans is a good thing, right? So she saw this as a need to adjust immigration policy maybe, but that this symbol was way musically we could welcome people. And I do think that music has a power to embrace and power to sort of create a broader community than we had before. And that's, I think, one of the powers of Francis Scott Key's song. There's really a long history of this happening. I mean, so the first foreign language translation that I'm aware of is from sort of the middle of the 19th century. It may have been actually created for a German community in Texas, but really becomes more prominent during the U.S. Civil War as a kind of recruiting tool.
Oh, wow.
And so this is a German version of the Star-Spangled Banner, which is, O sagt kann ich sehen in das Morgenroß Strahl, right?
Wow.
So, and it's published, at least in this version, probably in 1861 by a publisher in New York. And it has a picture around it. So there's the text translated all four verses into German, but it has a picture with a big flag and an eagle on top, and then a Civil War soldier, and then an African-American, probably a former slave in some kind of bondage. But this image was used for many different songs put out by this publisher, some of which were, you know, calling for Union volunteers. So this seems to be a text that's being used to bring sort of former or German-speaking peoples living in the United States and to recruit them for the Union cause, right? So you would have had, say, the Hessian troops that came over from England who were mercenaries, right, and fought in the initial War of Independence of the United States, who were really some of the strongest, you know, soldiers in the country. And their descendants, many of them stayed. Their descendants still had German-speaking communities. And so this was a quasi-official Union recruiting tool, you know, using the anthem in different languages. And this particular version was reprinted in German hymnals, and this was a popular way in which, or a common way anyway, in which translations of the of Key's texts appeared, they would be in Swedish and Norwegian and Czechoslovakian. And so communities, you know, that would be welcomed to the United States, and they would sort of coalesce largely around churches, right? And churches would have services in the original language. They would have hymnals in these original languages. And they would have a section of sort of, you know, Vaterland hymns or, you know, some kind of songs, national songs. And that would often include Hail Columbia and other patriotic songs, but also the Star-Spangled Banner translated into whatever the vernacular is of that church community. And it was a way, again, of assimilation, of sort of understanding, learning these symbols that were necessary to participate in American life and sort of, again, made people feel welcome, helped them sort of create a path toward citizenship, if you will. And then really we get into the 1930s and we have a sort of series of American interventions into Latin America, and Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, actually creates something he calls the Good Neighbor Policy, right? And so they develop translations of the anthem into Spanish that are sort of official State Department translations, which again are meant to make friends, right, with Latin American countries. And to the point where the State Department actually calls in 1945 for a new translation, and a woman named Clotilda Arias, who is actually a Peruvian composer living in New York, has the sort of winning Spanish translation. It replaces this 1919 translation. It's a little bit more singable, more comfortable in terms of the language, and it's easy of matching it to the original melody, but it's called El Pendrón Estrellado. So it's, you know, again, this sort of official government action to use Key's text as a way of embracing and sort of facilitating international relations, right? Not so much maybe about immigration at that moment, but interesting that we have these official government translations. One of the ironies, just to make clear, is that the 1931 bill that makes – signed by Herbert Hoover and passed by Congress – that makes Key's song the official national anthem doesn't have a text, doesn't have a musical arrangement, really nothing with it. It just says, the song known as the Star-Spangled Banner is the official anthem of the United States of America. It's very short, just a couple sentences. So at least officially, we don't have a particular musical arrangement. We don't have a particular text. We don't have an official English version, right, that says this is the only sanctioned text. And for me, that's sort of the magic of it, right, that if there was an official text, then if we sang it and performed it in exactly the right way, what we would be communicating is not love of country, really. It's not just, but rather is obedience, right? That we can follow the law.
Right.
So because there's not a law, I feel like it creates the opportunity for a much more sincere expression. So if you choose to sing it in a certain way, you're sort of, it's always a choice, right? Because there is no official version. There's a tradition to follow, certainly, but when you sing it in a way that has a particular sort of individual statement, or really when you sing it anyway, it always makes a statement about the participation of that singer and about yourself into this community represented by the song. So I think it's really important, actually, that we don't have a law. If we did, some of the magic and power of the song would be lost. But it turns out that really in this post-World War II era, there's lots of different translations. There's Yiddish and Hebrew, Native American languages, Cherokee, Lakota, Ojibwe, American Samoan, Cajun. There are even recent translations into Chinese and Japanese and Russian that are all done by individuals. And they all certainly represent languages spoken in this space we call the United States of America, right? So in a certain way, I think we'd have to translate it in order to embrace everybody who's here.
Right.
I can't imagine the Russian version appearing, you know, for a presidential inauguration, really. But, you know, so there clearly are times when English expresses the broadest or most American, because pretty much it's still the functional language of the United States.
When we think about the process of translating, can you share any insight about the challenge of maintaining the beauty of the lyrics and the poetic nature of the lyrics, but also the accuracy of the word's meaning?
I think there's always a tension between sort of a literal translation and then the ability, not so much to maintain the beauty of the language, but to maintain the ability to perform it as a song.
Right.
Right. So basically the number of syllables that are in the translation has to match the number of syllables in Key's original if we're going to stick to that same melody.
Right.
Your other problem becomes like rhyme scheme and things like that. So you have to make compromises on one end or the other, right? You either have to sort of bend the meaning a little bit, bend the literal translation to allow for a more singable translation.
Right.
Or you have to add a few extra syllables, a few extra notes here or there, maybe change the – let go of the unique rhyme scheme of eight – you know, rhymes and eight lines with an extra rhyme in line five, so nine total. So you have to let go of some of that sort of poetic, aesthetic content if you're going to have a more literal translation. So that's the tension, and I think it's shown particularly well by these sort of two sanctioned translations in Spanish, right? La Bandera de las Estrellas, which is from 1919, is sort of a little bit awkward, sort of a mixture of really formal and informal. Spanish speakers I've given it to sort of get a little cross-eyed as they look at the text. And then this Arias translation from 1945, which is much more singable, right? But it's still very faithful, but it tries to be to adjust the language, right?
So, right.
So the State Department was aware of that when they were looking for a new version in 1945.
The official version, right.
Exactly.
Can you tell us anything more? So we talked about some that have been more official, more state-sanctioned, and then others that are more just individually composed. Do you know anything about the individuals who are putting out content, putting out translations that they were inspired to create?
A little bit. So I think one of the interesting versions is the Native Hawaiian version. It was done, really for the University of Hawaii, right?
Okay.
Because again, one of the most common places for us to sing the Star Spangled Banner would be at sporting events, and so their football team, the Rainbow Warriors, became pretty popular. I think it just joined the Western Athletic Conference, and so actually, is a pretty strong team, and got some national exposure. And one of the things they did was translate the anthem into Native Hawaiian, right? Which was, again, I think works on many different levels as a kind of maybe tourism advertisement that we're Americans too, but we're sort of special. But it certainly makes a claim to these people who were sort of the most recent to join the United States. I mean, up through World War II, we had 48 stars on the flag, and we added Alaska and Hawaii. So it's bringing in Native Hawaiian really shows how there's a kind of – again, there were people there who became Americans sort of by, application and becoming a state. And there's a dual identity, right, between being Native and also being American.
Right.
And so we're – as individuals in our culture, we're constantly – navigating different identities, gender identities, members of states, members of, colleges and universities. We all have – there's all these different groups that we belong to, and we move pretty fluidly between them. So the Hawaiian translation of the anthem, I think, is sort of one way in which we did that. The Samoan translation, again, another one. So we have a U.S. territory rather than a state, right? Sort of a more, even distant relationship. Yet American Samoa, I think, provides the largest per capita – percentage of, U.S. soldiers of any place in the United States of America, right? So there's this very patriotic relationship to the country, and then sort of that government has proposed actually that their particular version of their translation be an official territorial translation.
Oh, wow.
For American Samoa. So it's there are sort of all these moments. We tend to not – they tend not to be personal claims, I think, when we get into these translations. There's really an attempt to sort of define a whole group. So it's really less about the individuals, I think, and more about sort of the whole language area.
Right. And the linguistic diversity of the United States and groups of people within the United States.
Absolutely. One interesting version, which you have right next to you there, is the French version.
Yes.
And we do have actually the person who's there, Alfred Delbruck, who's a composer, I think living in France. But what's interesting about that version actually comes out in 1918, and the translation is not very literal, right? So the translation really is talking more about sort of the power and sort of manliness of the United States. And it's, if anything, is a kind of aspiration from a country that was really France, right, that's really suffering in World War I, trying to sort of convince and compel the United States to become involved in and intervene in the war, which we had initially sort of stayed out of, right? But by 1917, 1918, we were sort of all into that war, and we actually turned the tide and liberate France, among other places. So there's a kind of appeal for aid and a kind of honoring of an ally that's really in that text that's pretty strong. So there's, I think in that case, it's not about literal translation, it's not about singing translation. It's actually a political, you know, adjustment of the text to try to embrace another meaning. So do you want to, you told me you spoke a little bit of French. You want to read a couple lines there?
Sure, I can read some lines and then do the direct translation. All you native French speakers out there, please forgive my errors. But so the lyrics go, étendard étoilé, notre emblème sacré, célébré par nos chants, par nos cris de victoire. Au milieu des combats, terrien du danger, tu flottes indomptable, enivré dans ta gloire. So this is saying starry emblem or starry standard, our sacred emblem, celebrated by our songs, by our cries of victory. In the middle of combat, full of danger, you are floating and enlivened by your glory. So that's, so it's different from, very different from the English, but exactly that sort of emotional impact and celebration is still present in these words.
You can imagine that if you're, you know, a French soldier and you're sort of tied down, you know, in trench warfare, and then you see the supporting troops with the Star Spangled Banner coming to your aid, that that sense of power and strength that's sort of represented in that text is pretty clear. Another fascinating text is the Yiddish and Hebrew translations that were done in the 1930s and 40s. Again, at a time of war, and I think, again, sort of calling for aid, you know, sort of making a claim that there's a Jewish population in the United States that is saying, we're here too, calling attention to themselves, we deserve support, and that, you know, for a long time, the United States, again, resisted going into World War II, even though it was becoming, you know, frighteningly obvious that there were real issues, you know, with the sort of Nazi treatment of the Jews in Germany, and it wasn't until Pearl Harbor attack that really the United States jumps into the war both in the Pacific and in Central Europe. But there was some of the groundwork for a lot of these relationships was actually laid by national anthems. So in World War I, that's sort of the first time we get to a sort of quasi-official or traditional version of the Star Spangled Banner, a version called the Service Version.
Okay.
And the Service Version, which was initially put together by sort of the U.S. military and working with the Department of Education, and also a group called the Music Supervisors National Association, which is now NAFME, or the National Association for Music Education. So that group still exists. But it was really coming out of K-12 education, sort of the need to have an official version of the song, because in the 19th century, there's a lot of different ways to sing it. Sometimes there's a repeated chorus.
Right.
Sometimes the rhythm's a little different. It was really teachers in the classroom who were using the anthem as, again, a way to build community, socialize students into being American, right? Taking all of these immigrants really who had come through in the Industrial Revolution and sort of represented and probably spoke even different languages at home to get them to share a single version of the anthem. But curiously, they were also singing the French national anthem and sort of other, you know, Belgian national anthem and the English anthem and sort of as a way of, again, building an awareness that the United States was really part of a whole community of nations that all had these anthems.
Right.
And so it's really at World War I that we see this sort of huge uptick in the number of publications, performances, a kind of, you know, patriotic power of the U.S. national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner.
Right.
Even more so than in the Civil War, which is, of course, critical, or World War II. It's really, I guess, the pivot point that launches the sort of social practice of the anthem as being truly national, really comes out of World War I, even though it's not until 1931, as I mentioned, that it becomes officially the anthem of the United States. It's really in social practice has already been true. And so Herbert Hoover's signature is just recognizing, you know, something that really the people have already created.